Welcome to the latest Watercolors Aquarium Gallery podcast, brought to you from the Aquarium Rush Studios in downtown Grand Rapids, Michigan. We're going to have some fun today. We got a really cool topic. I think it'll be an interesting topic. We're going to kind of see where it goes. My name is Ben.
I'm Amy.
And I'm Charles.
Today we're going to talk about designing an aquarium around specific fish. But before we get to that, Charles has a monumental thing that happened.
I know. I'm about to retire my first notepad for the podcast. Today is the last page of notes I have, and then I'm moving on to the next one.
So part of the reason this is monumental, Amy's doing a little chuckle. How's your notepad, Amy?
My notepad is a piece of notebook paper I ripped out of a spiral-bound notebook at home with a bunch of scribbles on it. So that's what I've got. What do you got, Ben?
Yeah, I have a piece of paper I printed out about 10 minutes ago.
Sometimes it's a sticky note. Sometimes it's
it's the notes on my phone.
Charles has a majestic leather-bound notebook holder that he's using that's so pristine.
You can see on the new pad, the stuff that we haven't talked about yet, so I've transferred over. But what's really I was looking back on this, and the part that was really fascinating to me is that you could tell at first I hadn't quite honed down how to take notes during the podcast, what was important, what wasn't. So the style of note-taking on the first page and the last page are very different.
When he's talking about he hasn't honed down how to take notes during the podcast, Amy and I are both going, oh, that's right, he takes notes during the podcast.
Oh, yeah. I think I remember at one point saying, Charles, write this down. So,
well, you know, we do pick on him a little bit. But
this list right here, these are all things you've told me to write down that we haven't, that hasn't become relevant yet.
What would we do without Charles?
Well, see, that's the thing, right? We're picking on him a little bit here. But really what it comes down to it, the only reason you ever hear us talk about something and say, hey, we should get into that in more detail in the next podcast, the only reason, the only way that ever actually happens is because Charles takes notes.
Yep. Yeah. So this is definitely a milestone. We've been at this for a little while now.
I know, right?
Yeah, so that was kind of the moment that hit me that we've been chugging along on this. Yes.
I mean, in a couple months, it'll be a year.
Wow.
Yeah.
that's pretty cool.
It is very cool.
Give me a little
thanks,
chill.
Thanks, man. Nice job.
Thanks.
I appreciate all you do.
Excellent. All right. Are we ready to talk about fish now?
Yeah, let's get into it. So the idea for this podcast came about while we were thinking about what inspires somebody to do an aquarium. And often it's because somebody's going for a look, or they want to do an African cichlid tank, or they want to do a planted tank, or they want to breed tetras or something. And it's set up because you want a fish tank. Mm-hmm. But how often do we say, I want to keep fish X and I want it to be in a display that's designed around that fish? Mm-hmm. There are some fish that we absolutely have to do that with. And I'm not going to go into those. One of them would be like a goldfish.
Yeah.
Right. If you are going to keep goldfish, you have to design that tank specifically around goldfish. And I would say those of us that know at least a little bit about what we're doing are going to say, I'm going to do a goldfish tank. And we know better than to just say, I'm going to have this tank and I might put some goldfish in it. I might put this in it. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of an example of at least how I interpreted how we were doing this topic.
I mean, and it's sort of like the antithesis of a lot of people get into so much trouble by doing a onesie twosie tank, like ooh, this one's pretty, that one's pretty, this one's pretty, I'm gonna throw them all together. And like, this is the opposite side of that spectrum.
Right. Planning.
Yeah,
it's important.
I definitely remember when I set my first tank up, it was, I got a tank, I put a filter on it, I put some gravel in it, I put some plastic plants in it, and then I went to the fish store to see what fish I wanted to put in it.
Yeah. And I think that's a pretty common angle that people take when they're just starting to get into it, because how would they know any different?
Yeah.
But it can be really, really fun to just be like, how do I show off this fish the best? Right. And then everything else goes around that. So that's what we're talking about today.
Okay, so I'm curious about something. Part of the inspiration to me about this topic was the way you described how you keep your buffalo heads.
Mm-hmm.
Was that one of your fish?
I did put it on there.
Oh, good.
Just because I've like hinted at it a million times, yeah. And I feel like I should really get into it and describe exactly what I'm doing there. So
we always make you go first.
I can start with that one.
Do you wanna?
Sure.
Okay.
All right. So pretty much, this is the setup that I've designed specifically around my buffalo heads, but I think it would work for pretty much any burrowing fish and pretty much any cave spawners. So the way that I set up this tank is, it's kind of similar to, if you've ever seen people do like those slate layouts where they're building up structure.
Yeah.
I start with the rock structure and
what's
build
size tank?
My tank right now is a 64 gallon long. I had a pretty similar setup in a 40 breeder before. 64 gallon long is just a 75, but shorter, but it's rimless. So it's a little bit 48 different.
48 by 18 by probably 12 inches tall.
Yeah, I think 12 inches.
That's a really cool size.
It's a great size. I love this tank.
Is that rimless?
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
It's beautiful. Yeah, I love it. Perfect. And the extra foot that I get out of it versus my 40 breeder and the extra little bit of width lets me do this so much better.
Oh, yeah.
So
I bet that's 14 inches tall, not 12. I bet it's a little...
What is this? A 75 is 18, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I can't remember if it's 12 or 14.
It is. 10 gallon is 12 inches tall.
Oh,
so
yeah.
So that's like really short.
It's probably 14 gallons. Yeah.
14 inches.
Or 14 inches.
Yeah, that's perfect. I love it.
Yeah, I really like this tank. This is probably going to be one of my favorite sizes from here on out because I just kind of like it. So I start off with rock structure. I do lay down substrate first just because I don't think there's much of a reason not to. I know people get really nervous about burrowing fish knocking rocks over. But if you do it pretty stably, I don't think that's much of a concern because they're going to dig fairly slowly around stuff. So make sure that you got nice caves that are already built into the rock. And what I pretty much do is get the rocks, put driftwood over top to sort of limit entrances. Part of the reason that a lot of fish get really territorial is because they feel like they can't defend their homes. So having narrow entrances makes it so that they have all the space they need on the inside, but they don't need to fight everything within a 1 foot radius in order to make sure that they have that secured. And then I just start building up the substrate layer over that.
What substrate?
Right now I have a mix of sand, EcoComplete, and soil.
Like topsoil or like?
I have stratum actually.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so it's been an evolution of substrate. I've had this substrate for like 4 or 5 years and it's been like building as I add more things, but
like completely mixed or is it?
It's completely mixed
completely
at
mixed.
This point.
So it's not like there's a section in front that's got the sand. And
Nope.
Because you got diggers.
I started out separating it and that fell apart the first time I moved it. So I don't know that I would necessarily recommend that, but you do want substrate that's loose enough that things can move it. I don't think big pea gravel is a great option for digging fish because it tumbles back in and it's really difficult for them to work with. So you can pretty much fill in those burrows and they will find a way to clear it out. I haven't even gotten to this point in this tank yet because I do this slowly as I'm working with the tank, as in I usually plant the outside of the tank first, and then as those plants start to grow, I will add soil over top of my structure and let the plants grow up over top of it. That's the only way you can really hold in a mound or a hill, and that's really what I'm trying to recreate here. So slowly filling over areas and adding plants on top. It can be kind of tricky to figure out what portions of the rock work you want exposed or not when you're really trying to aquascape it in a way that looks nice. But I don't like aquascaping my tanks and then just letting them sit. I want to sort of build the tank with the fish. That's the whole point of doing this. So
you want to play.
Yeah. So if they decide that this is the entrance they want to use and no plants are allowed to go there, I'm out of luck. No plants get to go there. There's nothing I can do about that. But it ends up being that perfect environment that they want. So it's pretty fun.
So are you watching them like grab mouthfuls of soil and substrate and run inside the thing and spit it out? And
yep. I can always tell right before they're about to spawn because I will see. And because I have mixed substrate, it's kind of graded. There's sand on the bottom and then EcoComplete and the soil kind of tends to sit on the top. Mm. Because that's how it filters down. So if I see a big pile of sand on the front of it, I know that they've dug down to the bottom and that's right before they're going to spawn.
Right. So you're this is Staticrinus Casaris, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
How many times do you think they've spawned in your tank?
In this tank, not yet. It takes them at least a couple of months to start. But probably five? It's hard to know for sure because they just sort of keep on doing it once they start. But
are they raising babies?
Oh, yeah.
How many babies? Like, have you gotten any out of it?
I've gotten some out of it, but I don't breed them to raise a ton of them. So I don't often feed all the babies to raise them. Right. And that's like a tough thing to talk to people about, but I'm not looking for production here. I just like having a stable population of fish. So there's usually a stable population of the two adults, three or four large juveniles. One or two will make it to adulthood, and then like 20 or 30 tiny babies at a time.
You're looking at being able to constantly observe as close to a natural behavior as possible.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So,
which I think is the point of this, the point of this talk is, okay, if you're designing a system, if you're designing an aquarium and an aquascape around a specific fish, mm-hmm. you're going to get the behavior. And the behavior is going to include spawning.
Yeah. So for spawning behavior, they're going to want a nice flat area to spawn. A flat rock is usually where they seem to prefer it. But
are they spawning in the caves? Or are they laying the eggs outside the caves and protecting them?
They will spawn in the cave, but they will do a pretty grand display beforehand. Mm. So he'll usually post up on a rock and like you can see him flirt, and then they'll be like, all right, let's take this back to our place. And
nice.
And then they will go in there, and then I don't see the female for probably a couple of weeks until she comes out. And then they will both protect and raise them together. So they're really fun fish to watch do their thing. They're fantastic parents. They will herd the fry around. I have some pretty decent sized predatory tetras in there, and I'm sure they pick off a handful, but not many. And so we covered spawning, we covered breeding ground, and this is part of how I design my tanks is I want different areas for different purposes. So for the fry, lots of driftwood, and especially those gnarled pieces that they can really get into and hide in, makes a huge difference in how many I see actually come through. I think if I were to feed the tank for 100 cichlids, I'd have 100 cichlids, but I don't particularly want that. And I don't, naturally, that's not the rates that you're going to get anyway. Those two or three that make it to adulthood is pretty normal,
right?
In an environment like that. So,
okay, so we're going to answer a bunch of questions for the techie stuff, right?
Yeah.
So I worked with this fish probably 20 years ago now, and this was pre-internet, and there was, you know, I wasn't doing any actual research mm-hmm. on the fish other than keeping them alive, and it had a gorgeous group of adults that never did anything. And I know that part of it, after talking to you about your tank, is because of the size of the substrate I was using. There was no opportunity for them to dig any kinds of burrows. Mm-hmm. But some of the people listening are going to be going, hey, I have, and I'm thinking of trying it up here, actually, because I really, that's a fish that I worked with and was unsuccessful, and now I see some ideas on how to be successful with it. All of the techie stuff, so all of the details, right? Mm-hmm. Temperature.
I think it's like 78.
All right, so you're running a heater in there.
Yeah.
equipment. Go through your equipment.
I have a canister filter on there. I think it's a Fluval 306. Mm-hmm. I have a heater. I have lights.
What lights?
I have AI freshwater AI primes, which I actually, nice. I love the effect that those have, and you can use them to really bring out. They have like an iridescent blue eye under low light that's gorgeous.
Oh, wow.
And it's really, I have a power head on there because they do appreciate the flow, and so do my other fish. Well, a circulation pump's probably Corellia. More accurate. Mm-hmm. Hydrocorellia. Actually, oh yeah. Nope, it's the Ceche Voyager Nano.
Okay.
Yeah. I know it's not a Corellia because it hasn't shocked me yet.
Jeez.
But I use that to sort of treat that rock structure as the embankment and the front section of the tank as like the river front.
CO2?
No CO2 on that system right now.
Lots of plants?
Lots of plants, yep. soft leaf plants are probably best avoided because they will kind of eat them. But if you've got some nice fluffy hair algae, they'll also eat that and they prefer it. So I actually, since I have that huge crinum in there, the leaves that are right up by the light always grow a nice, like, healthy layer of hair algae on them. And the plant itself is growing and healthy, but that is a lot of the area that those fish and their fry graze on.
Oh, nice.
Because they're true omnivores that lean pretty hard into herbivore.
Which crinum?
It's Calum nostratum.
Okay.
Yeah, I've got like a... It's probably a little over 5 feet long crinum Calum nostratum in there. So it's the centerpiece of the tank. It's beautiful. And the tank, I just moved like 2 months ago, and in terms of a tank like that, like, it's still brand new again. So not looking the way it's supposed to, but it's getting close.
Right. What other fish do you have in there with them?
Right now, I just have my four. I've got I mentioned my large predatory tetras. They're the Kuiper's eye tetras. They're probably about 3 or so inches. And some handful of barbs. I don't have much in that tank right now.
Which barbs?
They are the bony-lipped barbs. You remember we had those ones?
Oh, those are really cool.
Which are... I really lean hard into algae-eating fish because algae is easy to grow and that makes fish easy to feed. But
true.
All I'm feeding that tank is New Life Spectrum pellets. They pretty much never get frozen or live foods of any kind because I'm pretty lazy about that. But that's enough.
And speaking of lazy, I'm guessing it's just straight tap water.
Just straight tap water, fairly regular water changes, but it's pretty lightly stocked. So I don't
go too crazy. I assume it's dechlorinated.
Most of the time.
Yeah, it might take a home too. Most of the time.
Top off, never. But when I do a water change, I usually remember the pry.
At some point, I know I still have to make some custom lids for the tank, and I haven't forgotten. I know it's been...
You just got
to
get the glass. So yeah, there's probably a ton more I can get into. Those fish are a blast to watch. If you accidentally put a plant in front of their burrow, they will rip it up and it will be very dramatic, but that's part of the fun.
Oh yeah. In our last podcast, it was some fish that make us smile.
Mm-hmm.
And watching, one of mine was pairs of cichlids raising fry. And anytime you can get that natural behavior, that fry raising behavior, I think that's one of the main draws of the entire cichlid genus.
Yeah, especially when they're monogamous like this and actually both raise them. Oh, it's such a blast. Yeah. One of my favorite clips I've ever gotten of them is one where, like, I had been stuffing random Anubias in random holes and I must have put them in the wrong spot. And the female's trying to drag it out and she's just, like, struggling and for, like, 30 seconds. And then the male comes up and he just yanks it because he's twice the size of her.
Right.
Just yanks it out and then starts doing his like little spawning dance. Like, yeah, did you see that? That was really sexy. I know. And then they go back in the cave like, all right, we're going to go back and do this.
You have earned this, buddy.
Yep. That's that was like their cool version of him finally taking out the garbage, right?
And he got his little reward.
Yep. They're adorable. It's going to be hard for me ever not to keep these fish.
Right.
So yeah, I think I talked like forever about that, but I'll pass it on. If anybody has any other questions, please let me know.
Well, no, I think that was the idea of this talk, to go into that kind of depth. That's why we only did three of them because, you know, this is not just a, hey, this fish is cool, design a tank around it. This is, here's the fish. This is why you should do a tank around it.
Mm-hmm.
This is how I did it. Or this is how it should be done.
And when they have all those babies out there, it's absolutely worth... If I didn't add any other fish, that tank would be worth watching all the time. Yeah.
That's awesome. I love it. Very cool. All right, Charles. What kind of stuff have you been making up in the last 10 minutes?
So the first thing I wrote down was cherry barbs.
Interesting choice.
Excellent.
Mostly because I feel like I've talked cherry barbs up a lot in this podcast, and I think I need to explain what I think the ideal cherry barb tank would be then.
I like it.
So off the bat, my head is picturing like one of those 12-gallon rimless we have downstairs.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're a Sri Lankan native, and they, if you see photos of them in the natural habitat, their natural habitat, like the streams they're in, are only like 3 to 6 inches deep. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking what you'd want to do is try to replicate that. And this is, I think, a setup that lends itself really well to, you know, like the driftwood coming up out of the water type situation. And so I think really lean into that and have like Java ferns coming, going up out of the water and back down into it. And I don't know what kind of substrate specifically you'd want to go for. I think it depends on what kind of stream you want to replicate. But depending on what kind of substrate you're working in, there's, you know, crips, Java ferns, Java moss. And I think what you want to do is have like the driftwood going down in specific ways from the edges down towards the center and have kind of, I'm trying to think of how to want to describe this, like these alleys of open water. Because my experience has been that the females tend to like to hang under ledges and the males will set them up like in these alleyways and they'll show off because that's where they can be seen. And so I think you really want to try to aquascape it in a way that gets as many of those alleyways as you can so that you can have those males each having their own like little platform, so to speak.
Sri Lanka is going to be not necessarily just soft water there, right?
Yeah, it's pretty variable to my knowledge.
And lots of close to neutral and some of it even a higher pH. So you could definitely use some rock structure to create those alleyways.
Yeah, you could.
Without having a negative effect on the pH.
Yeah. I mean, it wouldn't be biotypically correct, but you could put boosts on those rocks if you were.
The idea of this is not biotope.
Yeah.
This is what's going to show, you're designing a tank around cherry barbs and what's going to show those off and get the natural behavior out of them the best.
Yeah.
And that alleyway idea, that's a cool concept. I like that.
Yeah. I don't know. It's just every time I've had a tank with them, I kind of, looking back on them, I wish I'd done them a little different. And that's what this topic is, because the last time I had a true cherry barb display was about 10 years ago. So my aquascaping skills were very different than they are now.
Yeah.
And so what I would do is the tank was divided up in thirds. So triangular thirds. So the two thirds in the back would have had plants and stuff so that there's like in the middle triangle. And that's where the dominant whale would always display. But I've always been like looking back on it, I'm curious that if I had more alleyways, would more males have been displaying?
If you're doing a group of cherry barbs, is there most likely going to be a hierarchy?
My experience has been yes, but I am curious if you had more areas for males to display, would they be a little bit more freeform in that?
I wonder if those alleyways would break up territories a little bit and
each
have their little microhabitats and
or allow the subdominant males to like get a sneaky moment to show off.
Right.
Yeah. Would they, cause I feel like you would get a lot more of that social dynamic, because when there was just one spot, it was definitely the one male that was dominant was displaying the most and the other males would try to get out there, but they would either usurp them or they immediately get shoved back into the corner.
Right.
So if you had more variation in your aquascaping, would the other males come out and display in these, like, I assume there would be the ideal spot that everyone wants, but would the males display out of sight and would they get females? That's what I want to know.
Would, do you think there are other fish that would complement, or do you think that the fish, other fish would detract?
I think with cherry barb specifically, other fish would detract.
So you would think this would be a species-only tank?
Yeah, unless you were going to do something like a coolie loach or Cory cat, something that would hang down on the bottom and be completely out of the way of the cherry barbs trying to do their thing.
A group of coolie loaches hanging out in those alleyways, that might be a pretty cool complementary fish to that system.
Yeah.
This also seems like a perfect tank for that sunbeam castle effect.
Oh, yeah.
With the driftwood, like, that, mm-hmm. It would give you these really, really unique, beautiful shadows.
Yeah. for anyone listening, we have a biotope downstairs with a Kessel, and it's like offset on the side and pointing at an angle. And it, like, conceptually, I know you're going to be listening and be like, why? But if you could see it,
it looks like the sun shining through,
like the canopy. It's so cool. Yeah. So keep track on our YouTube channel for as those updates are coming out, because that tank is stunning.
Yeah. And I think it would look just as beautiful on the setup you're talking about.
Yeah. You could get away with a smaller Kessel though in this tank size. Yeah.
The Kessel 80 would do the job.
I mean, but also, like, these are, we don't have to pay for these tanks. Do it in like a 40 long or something. Or like a 12 gallon long, but like if it was 3 feet long instead of a 2 feet long or something.
Yeah. I want to see people, I'm trying to encourage people, I want to see more people using that 12 gallon rimless, because I think that is a great small tank size that you can do a lot in with very little effort.
That's the one that's long and skinny, right?
Yeah.
It's the one that's low.
Yeah. It's like, it's basically got the footprint of a 15, but it's like a few inches shorter.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay.
It's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What would you filter it with?
I'm just thinking, you know, with the rocks or the driftwood, if you did like a small canister filter, you could probably hide your equipment and not see it at all.
Yeah.
And that,
you don't really need the river effect with that. You don't need that flow.
No, but you could probably get a little bit of a directional flow, but you don't need a lot. Mm-hmm. Just because, I mean, like 2 inches of water doesn't normally have a lot of speed down it. But I think I would go with the canister filter, all things considered, if like nothing else was an issue, just because I think you could actually make it look like it's not there.
You know, if with the size of that tank, if you put an Owazi Thermo 150,
you wouldn't even need your heater in the tank.
Exactly. Yeah. So the Owazi has their line of thermo canister filters that have a built-in heater in the canister. So it's completely out of your display.
So cool.
Yeah, the more I've worked with, what's the size we have on the 40 downstairs?
That's the 250.
Yeah. The more we've worked with that one, the more I've liked it.
They're great.
So
Sorry. Not 250, that's the 200.
Okay.
Yeah. So there's the 100 and the 200, and then the 250 and the 350, and then I think a 600. And the 100 and the 200 are like a real nano canister filter kind of design. The 250 and the 350 are more like, this is a big robust, you're putting it on a larger tank. But I'll have the built-in heater.
They're so cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I know it sounds gimmicky, but it's the more, like I said, the more I've worked with it, the more impressed I've been. I really love that the bio media like chamber is directly surrounding the heater that they put in there.
Right.
Just because biomedia, let's say nitrifying bacteria, do better in an environment where they're not getting sunlight and have higher heat. So
heat
like being, so being right next to the heater, they just work better.
Do you think that cherry barbs in a planet aquarium, do you think that complements cherry barbs?
Like, yeah,
would you
put
plants in there?
I would. I would skew in the direction of epiphytes just because that's what they're easy.
Right.
And, but also like crypts and stuff like that. Stuff that has some leafiness to it, some girth.
Yeah.
Because the females definitely like to hang out underneath a leaf or something, just peeking out, and they'll pop their head out if they're interested and stuff. But like that be like that kind of like, you know, like hanging out at the edge of the party until you see the guy that you're into.
Right.
Like that's the type of behavior I want to see replicated in this tank.
Oh, plus getting some good greens in there will give you amazing contrast on those fish.
Yeah.
The green and red combo works really well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Excellent choice. And I love it that you're taking like one of the staples in the hobby and saying, okay, what can we do to make this bam? Cool. One of my fish, by the way, is the same kind of idea that I'm just taking a very normal fish and saying, optimize.
Yeah. If we treated every fish the way that we treat discus, what would our tanks look like?
Yeah.
You know, it's funny that you bring that up.
It's is that what you want to talk about next, that's, Ben?
Now that is my turn. Discus was the first one I was going to bring up.
Go ahead. I'm done.
All right.
Yeah, let's hear it.
Yeah. So I part of the reason that I brought up discus is because that is one of those fish that I think if you are going to have discus, that is where you start. And I think that's relatively accepted that if you're going to do a discus tank, you're doing a discus tank, right? Nobody said, people say, I'm going to do a discus tank. Nobody says I'm going to do an angelfish tank. Lots of people put angels in their tank,
mm-hmm.
right? If you did an angel tank, it would be better. That's one of my alternates, by the way. A little teaser. And nobody says I'm going to do a cherry barb tank unless right. they're going to breed them, right? But when you say, often it's said, that's the way I'll say that, I'm going to do a discus tank.
Mm-hmm. And people know what you mean, too.
Exactly. And I think that, you know, between your talk about your description of your buffalo heads and the way we think about discus, that kind of what made this whole concept evolve, that we need to look a lot of fish the way we look at discus,
mm-hmm.
because look what happened when you looked at that with your buffalo heads,
mm-hmm.
right? So anyway, there's the little tangent about why discus had to, of course, be on this list, because like I said at the beginning, it is very difficult to do discus without discus being the very focus of your tank.
Yeah.
At the shop, when somebody says, I want to do a discus tank, there are three things we bring up that you have to focus on with discus that you don't necessarily have to consider a focus with other fish. And the first one that everybody knows about is heat.
Ah.
Discus want it hot. And this is where I get to tell my fun story about Ted Judy. So Ted Judy is one of those really cool aquarium guys who's been in this hobby for a long time. If you haven't heard that name, Google him. He does amazing stuff. He writes articles.
Yeah,
he was
Ted's Fish Room is his current.
Yeah.
Ted's Fish Room. I think he's still, yeah, he's still doing stuff under that.
Yep. And it's gone through all kinds of different iterations and things like that. But anyway, for a while, Ted was importing fish from Peru. And he brought us, he also comes here to come fly fishing with me sometimes. And, you know, that's fun. That's a whole different topic. So Ted was on his way to come fly fishing. I mean, bring us some fish. And he said, hey, should I bring you some of the wild discus that I imported from Peru? I'm like, heck yeah, man, bring us some discus. He brought to us these amazing sky blue wild-caught Peruvian discus.
Ooh.
Did you see those?
No, but I can picture. The wild ones just have that incredible particular look about them that's just. I love the domestic ones, too, but they're so cool. Yeah,
these were gorgeous. And we had a tank set up down in the basement in our quarantine apartment at 85 degrees, ready to take these discus. Brought them in, like, cool, Ted, these are awesome. Got stuff acclimated, got stuff going. He took off to get us ready to go fishing. And I'm like, yeah, well, I'll be back in about, I don't know, 5 or 6 hours when I'm done with my work day. And then we can go hang out, go fishing. About 2 hours later, I went downstairs to go look at these discus and they looked bad.
Oh.
They had like funky white stuff growing on them and they're laying, not quite laying on the bottom, but they're doing that whole gaspy thing. Like a fish is in trouble kind of look.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh no, apparently, you know, they're wild caught. So I'm expecting, I'm not surprised by something not being right, but still I'm worried about these discus. I mean, they were not cheap discus. So I called Ted up and said, hey, what kind of medication should we use in these discus? And his reaction surprised me. He went, what? What do you mean? They don't need medications. Those discus are great. I'll be right there. So he ran down here. Ran down to the basement. I was doing stuff upstairs. So basement is where the quarantine department is. And I was working with customers and doing stuff upstairs. I could hear him like shuffle around stuff, moving around stuff and messing with stuff. And about 10 minutes later, he came upstairs and said, there, they'll be fine. And he left. I'm like, oh, okay. And it was probably an hour before I was able to get back down there and go look at the discus. And I walked downstairs and I looked at these discus and they looked perfect. The white was gone. They weren't gasping. And they were looking at me like, dude, what's up? We're hungry. Give us some food. Like now. Like, feed us now. You know, that begging thing that, mm-hmm. that cichlids do. And I, like, like, wow, these are so cool. And I touched the tank. I'm like, whoa, that tank is hot. And I realized that what Ted had done is he had found every heater he could find in the shop, and he got the temperature in the discus tank up to 95 degrees.
Oh, my gosh.
95.
I'd be mildly uncomfortable in 95. I know, for right? a long time.
This is like, you know, borderline hot tub temperature.
Yeah.
And these discus were like, ah, I'm loving life now. So that, and I called Ted and like, dude, 95, man. He said, yep, exactly. Keep it 95 for 3 weeks and then bring him down to 90. Don't drop him below 90.
Keep
wow. those discus hot. And they love it. So that was my really long story because I really want to tell that story, really. Is
it's a good story.
It's an excuse, right? But temperature, number one, temperature with discus. So if you're designing a tank around discus, really, if you're going to keep discus at all, design the tank around them. And then if you're going to do that, remember you want to keep it hot. So a good quality, reliable heater with a backup, good quality, reliable heater, because you do not want that tank to get below 85. And really, around 90 is where they're going to love it. But so there's number one, temperature, which, oh, by the way, means if you're going to keep any other fish with those discus, they have to also be able to handle 90 degree water. That's a select few.
Yeah.
Yep. Number two, when it comes to people saying, I want to do a discus tank, food. They don't do well on standard, regular tropical aquarium flake. They really want protein. It used to be back in the 80s and 90s when I was just getting into fish, and there were these hardcore, crazy, wacko people that were the discus keepers. And this was when discus, everybody knew discus were
impossible.
Impossible and super cool and amazing.
But yeah.
Everybody wanted discus because it was this giant, unmatched, beautiful fish that was really difficult to keep alive. So if you successfully did it, you were an aquarium guru just because you kept discus alive.
Right.
And these guys were going to the butcher shop and they were buying beef hearts and grinding up beef heart. Yes, cow hearts, right? And mm-hmm. that was like considered standard discus food. And it worked because they want such a high protein diet. So again, the fish that you're going to put with your discus have to be able to handle that kind of high protein diet.
Because a lot is going to fall down to the bottom yeah. and get eaten by everything else. Because
you're
going
to need to feed the heck out of them.
Which probably brings us to your third point.
Right. Thanks, Amy. It's like you know me or something.
But yeah. They're messy eaters and they need a lot of messy foods.
Yeah, yeah. And if they don't get enough food, they're just not going to do well.
Yeah.
And so there's the other question when it comes to tank mates for discus. If you put really aggressive feeding fish with discus, they're going to intimidate the discus. Discus are almost like they're polite.
Yeah.
they're going to go out, there's food happening, and then other fish are going to rush in to get the food. They're like, oh, sorry guys. We'll wait. Let us know when you're done and we'll be glad to come up and get the rest of the food.
What's that character's name from Office Space? The guy that just like gets like dunked on the entire movie. And he's like, that
guy with the staples, with the staples, but that's my stapler.
Yeah, that's discus.
Yeah. Except they never do that last final thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? They just slowly waste away and then die.
Yep.
And that competitive thing applies to other discus too. It's not like only if you add crazy fish in there. It's those two dominant discus are going to be those aggressive eaters that the other ones are going to kind of retire. So it's not even that you have to make sure to feed them high quality foods. It's that you have to make sure that you feed all of them high quality foods and find the little one that doesn't come up because he's too shy.
You got to look for those little signals with discus. And if they're slowly swimming in the background where everybody's eating, that's a sign that that's an intimidated discus.
Yeah.
And actually the black barring, if they get the black barring, those are stress stripes. If you see black barring on one of your discus, pay attention to that discus. And we're talking about a $50 to $100 or even more than that fish.
Yeah.
You want to pay attention to absolutely every single fish.
Yeah, they should all have a name.
Pushed over.
You should pay attention to every cherry barb too.
You should, but if you don't pay attention to every cherry barb, they'll figure it out. Yeah, Discus will just be like, okay, I'll go die now. I'm just never gonna eat again.
Yep. So if you don't feel like going to your local butcher, what would you be feeding your Discus?
Now there are actually a lot of really good prepared foods. There's the frozen Discus foods specifically. There are Discus flake, but I think also supplementing those with some bloodworms is absolutely necessary.
I think you can actually get frozen beef heart now too in cubes, because we've had that before.
Yeah, you can. And actually that was around back in the 80s and 90s as well. But you know, frozen beef heart is like $3.99 for 16 cubes.
Yeah.
And I think a beef heart, when you buy it from a butcher, you know, because that's not really a high demand thing that every butcher ends up with. Mm-hmm. I think they were buying a whole beef heart, which is like 3 or 4 pounds. For like $5 or $6.
I believe it. I bet it's still not much more than that.
But it's still, you know, then you're taking a beef heart home, this big bloody raw thing, and grinding it. And
oh, they're disgusting.
Oh, yeah.
All right, Ben, what's number three?
I think I went through the three.
Right? No, we talked about temperature of food, and we alluded to the third one, but we did not mention it.
I was going to talk about tank mates.
You're talking about tank mates as the third one?
You wanted me to talk about water quality?
That's what I wanted to talk about, yeah.
All right. So we can just use, we'll go into tank mates as like the afterthought.
Yeah. Well, we mentioned tank mates a little bit too.
So Discus can actually develop a weird melanoma if water quality gets bad. If you see Discus that have a whole bunch of black spots on their face, people call it freckling, that has been linked to high nitrates.
I did not know that it's been linked to melanoma.
So melanoma, not carcinogenic melanoma.
Yeah. So right? It's like a literal freckle.
Right. Black spots on fish is a melanoma.
Huh. Right. Yeah, I guess that makes sense.
So like if you see a swordtail that's like half black, those are melanistic pigments.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. I've never really thought through what freckling is.
I know, right? In Discus, it's been linked to high nitrates. So what does that mean for you potential Discus keepers out there? It means water changes, water changes, water changes.
Yeah. If you're feeding them like what we just described, you just have to.
40% once or twice a week. That's pretty normal. And there are Discus keepers that I know that are like hardcore into breeding Discus that are doing 70-80% water changes 3 or 4 times a week to keep their Discus at optimum prime condition. Now, I think there are some ways to get around some of that. I think 40% once a week is minimum, regardless of what you're doing.
So a python's your best friend, huh?
Python is your best friend.
But the problem there might too be a little bit the way that we keep Discus. You want to keep like a dozen of them in a 125. If you kept,
because it looks so good.
If you kept two of them in a 55, would you still need to do 40% a week water changes?
I think if you had and that was kind of what I was going to get.
Oh, sorry. Methods.
No, you're fine. That's okay. That I think that segue works.
Okay.
It's called live hard plants. Hitting reporting.
Yeah. Yeah. Live plants. Live planted Discus aquariums, I think, are underrated.
What? Mm. No, you can't keep plants with Discus. That's a lie.
Bare bottom only, right?
There's a whole list of plants that can take high temperature tolerance plants. I think Crystal Kessman's got it in the back of her book.
Yeah, she's got a whole chart of temperature tolerances on plants.
So, I can't tell you how often people come in and are like, wait, you have plants in your Discus tank?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, the plant that we have in our Discus tank that I think every Discus tank should have as a workhorse are the Amazon Zords. They just soak up so many nitrates. It's amazing.
Tons. I was going to go with Thalassinaria as the workhorse.
Yeah.
But a combination of Thalassinaria and Amazon Zords and Discus tank.
It works so well.
And it's gorgeous.
It is.
I love the look of Discus, like snaking. They don't really have a snaking movement, but like weaving.
Weaving.
Mm. Weaving their way through Val. Yeah. It's so cool.
That's amazing. Yep. So we touched a little bit on how careful you have to be with choosing tank mates for Discus and why. And I do want to touch a little bit on some of the fish that I think are fantastic tank mates with Discus. One of my favorite combinations is a pair or two of dwarf cichlids with Discus. Be that rams, of course, I'm going to choose Epistos, right? But we've actually all done it with some of the Nanochromis species. I think we had Nanochromis paralis or Nudiceps.
Splendens,
that's right. Thank you.
I told you I had a guy come in and buy all of our Cacatoides.
Oh, yeah.
As far as Discus tank.
Oh, I love it. And that works. Those are fish that even though
cool.
They can be pretty feisty feeders, you're just going to do a pair of them. And at that point, the Discus are big enough that the Epistos or the dwarf cichlids, whichever one you choose, they're going to be a little careful around those big fish. It's big groups of tetras that I really worry about.
Yeah. And that's what it seems like people want to do is big groups of rubby-nose or cardinals. And yeah, they are naturally found where Discus are found.
Yeah.
As prey.
Yeah. Now, so we're missing something actually. And I'm even going to talk about a weakness that I've discovered within watercolors. I don't know how that or why that is, but there are enough reports of people successfully keeping rubby-nose and cardinals with Discus that we're missing something. I don't know what it is yet.
It might be size of introduction.
Maybe.
Introducing small cardinals to medium Discus versus large cardinals to baby Discus and letting them grow up together, I'm thinking is the...
Or having a established population of cardinal tetras.
Could be.
And then introducing the Discus. I know when we tried introducing cardinal tetras, and these were medium to small Discus, and these were decent-sized cardinals, it was like Scooby Snacks.
Yeah.
I mean, they were just sucking them down like spaghetti.
I still think, and if somebody wants to prove me wrong, I would be so happy. They've still got to be losing a few here and there. Like, how would you, if you had a 125, let's say, just like, because I just mentioned it, with a dozen Discus and 200 cardinals, would you notice?
Yeah.
Or would you just be replacing them with a dozen every few months, regardless?
You're making a lot of sense.
I mean, maybe we are missing something. Yeah. I hope we are. Yeah. And
give
let
us
me
some
know.
Pointers. If you guys are doing discus with cardinals and rubby nose, let me know.
Because I think it looks beautiful. I love it. It's so cool.
Yeah.
I just, a little skeptical.
It's a fish to me, though, that doesn't need that.
No.
The accent, like, look at the amazing discus. And then there's, oh, wait, what was that down at the bottom? Oh, look at the dwarf cichlid. That
are somehow just as beautiful, you know?
Yeah.
I think there's... Yeah, I don't know. I feel like the schooling fish kind of just wash out the color of a discus when you have them in there.
It distracts.
I almost did cardinal tetra as one of my fish. Because if you do a tank focused around a cardinal tetra, it's an amazing tank. But I didn't because I wanted to do a discus tank.
I think there's one category of a good tank mate for discus that you haven't talked about yet, though.
I know what you're going to say. I think it's one of your favorite fish, right?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
I wonder, one of Charles' favorite fish, and I know he wouldn't say barbs. I don't remember what his other favorite fish is. I'm just kidding. So one of the fish we often use to fit, if you will, the niche of a dwarf cichlid in a well-planted aquarium is wild-type bettas.
No, I think you're wrong again.
What? Yeah. Corydoras sturbei.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Corys.
They are a warm water cory cat.
Oh, that's a good point. That's a good point.
And I do know several people in the area who keep sturbei corys in their discus tanks.
I'm curious which betta you were going to say.
I think that you could easily do chinoides with them.
Can they take the temperature?
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. That would be really cool. Mm-hmm. That would be really, really cool.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I was thinking sturbei corys.
Okay. Yep. For sure. Yes, absolutely. I thought you were talking about a whole category, like a group.
No, I knew specifically that he meant sturbei corys because it's a conversation we've had before.
Yeah, I think they're an ideal tank mate for discus tank.
I think I would do that. So I've been reading lately about some of the suckermouth catfish with discus, and there are lots of people claiming bristlenose plecos with discus. I'm willing to listen to some of the arguments for... But here's the thing about discus. They feed their fry on their slime layer, right? So it's an amazing, there's a behavior that is absolutely amazing to see. It's very difficult to replicate in an aquarium, but sometimes every once in a while it happens where you get a discus with this group of 50 or fry that are literally feeding off of the slime layer of the parent.
It's so cool.
It's amazing. It doesn't happen often in the aquarium, but the potential is there. But The implications of that are Discus have an extremely flavorful and nutritionally valuable slime layer. On purpose.
Sorry, I'm just picturing this. I just had a very vivid image in my head of like two plecos, like discussing slime coat layers, like wine connoisseurs.
It's got a little bit of an oaky flavor. Ooh, mine was a little more manzanita.
I think he's been hanging out in a tank with a lot of driftwood.
There's no question, and nobody can like go ahead and argue with me about keeping a regular Hypostomus plecostomus with a discus, and I'm going to tell you there's all kinds of reasons not to keep a common pleco with a discus or any other fish, but we know that's a bad idea.
Yeah.
And any of the carnivorous plecos, I can imagine that's a horrible idea.
Yeah.
There's some reports out there about standard bristlenose being okay with them, and I'd like to learn more about that one.
Although I could see the more carnivorous plecos are more of like hunters, and the more grazing plecos might even be more likely to latch onto something. I don't know.
The carnivorous ones are actually a lot more scavenging.
Mm.
And so they're going to go find some dead thing and scavenge off it.
Either way, I'd be so nervous about it.
None of those should ever be with discus, in my opinion. Again, I would love to hear some reports of somebody doing it successfully. By the way, 6 months is not success. 3 or 4 years is.
Yep.
Yep.
Same question you asked us, tank size and equipment.
I think a 90 gallon is a fantastic discus size.
You love that choice.
Some of the breeders are breeding successfully discus in a 29 gallon aquarium. Those are the ones that are doing 4 or 5 water changes a week.
Yeah.
29 gallons. Go for it. Sponge filter, 3 heaters, go for it. Discus display is really what we're talking about here. And then I think a 90-gallon aquarium, Fluval 406, or the Owazi, I think the 250 actually can handle 90 gallons just fine.
Maybe the bigger one for the bigger heater.
Yeah, that's a good point. I haven't rated the heater on the Owazi 250, so
you'd think it would be a little bit more efficient at maintaining high temperatures, so that might be something we should look into.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
Hmm.
But I think I would still, even if you're using an Owazi, I might still put a backup heater in the display itself.
Yeah. Probably better.
Yeah, that seems fair.
Yeah. I'm going to put a medium light on it so that I can grow Vallisneria like crazy. And I'm probably going to put Eco Complete on it. I don't know that I need to. I mean, sure, you could do you could find enough high tech plants to do a high tech planet aquarium with discus, but I just don't think it needs it.
No, I think simplicity is best there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm just trying to picture like a high tech planet aquarium with discus, and I'm like,
yeah, yeah. I think it detracts.
I think it detracts from both things.
Yeah, I agree.
Be like having a laser show and a disco ball in the same room. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah. 2 points, Charles. <Charles. laughs> I think you summed it up right there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there we go. To me, a quintessential discus aquarium is 90 gallons. Go big and add more discus. That's fantastic.
Right.
But
a 75 is just like a little bit not too small, but like a 90 is better.
I think those extra few inches really help.
It does.
When your discus are 5 or 6 years old, they're going to be close to 10 inches in diameter.
Yeah. I don't think people really appreciate how large discus are. You just don't see them that big very often. And it's not many people are dedicated enough to really do the discus setup.
Mm-hmm. That's the discus setup right there.
Love it.
Yep. That's how I do it.
All right.
Okay, Amy.
Can I actually want to steal this?
You do?
Because...
That's fine. I think we're pretty much... We're going into a two-parter here regardless. So we'll just commit to that.
Well, you guys, we have been talking about we were supposed to talk about 3 tank designs to make designed around a specific fish. But it turns out we have a whole lot to say about that.
Yeah, we've barely gotten started here. So
for all of you people that have been listening and been thinking, wait, we're on number 1.5 or whatever number we're on. I've lost track. And you guys got 3 to go. I'm getting bored here, guys. Okay, so we're going to have to wrap this up and move on to another one. In the meantime, I want you guys out there to think about some of those fish that you have, that what would make that environment or that ecosystem or that aquarium better for just that fish.
Yeah, let us know what your ideas are. We'll definitely catch back up with you. We're going to start part two of this episode next week. So in the meantime, we're not going to be able to answer your questions in the episode, but you can always send us an email to podcast@watercolorsaquariumgallery.com or a message or a call or whatever, however you want to find us.
Thanks a lot for listening and putting up with this apparently big, long topic.
Apparently, we just cannot keep our words to ourselves. So
let's have lots of fun and keep those hands wet.